A book can be magical in different ways. There's the beauty of the written word, the escape that comes from an intricate plot. But listen, not all magic is pixie dust and good vibes. The magic of a book can also exert a power that is negative. Take, for example, an illiterate slave whose owner uses the Bible to justify slavery. Imagine what the Bible must have looked like to that slave. Shireen Sherrod Johnson is an English professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She says we know a lot about how slaves looked at books because of the hundreds of slave narratives they wrote. A fundamental trope in those narratives is what is called the talking book. Steve Paulson sat down with Sherrod Johnson.
Shireen, let's start with the basic question. What is the talking book?
So the talking book is a trope in African American literature, and many people refer to it as the trope. A trope is just a recurring image or an idea that comes up again and again, and often with some difference or even evolution. The idea of the trope is that people see this as an originary idea in terms of the beginning of the African-American literary tradition. And so that's essentially what the talking book is. It comes out of a book by Henry Louis Gates called The Signifying Monkey, published in the late 80s. And from that idea, you have many of the thoughts that deal with the tension between literacy and orality. Mm-hmm. So it really tries to connect those two things.
Can you take me back to the first talking books? Can you give me an early example?
Right. So the first talking books came out of early African-American literature. And when people think about that, they usually think of slave narratives. And certainly one of them comes out of a slave narrative by Olodua Equiano, who wrote a slave narrative in the 18th century that is part memoir, part autobiography, part adventure, seafaring narrative. And so he has this instance where he talks about seeing a book and engaging with this idea of literacy in the Western tradition, that is the Enlightenment tradition, in the sense that being a man of letters is what made you a thinking being. And this was important in a period in which human beings were being turned into commodities. Just to give you an example, I think I can read one from Equiano, and then you'll see how there are two examples that I have, and I think the two together show exactly what the talking book was at its inception. So the first one comes from Equiano's narrative. I had often seen my master and Dick employed in reading, and I had a great curiosity to talk to the books, as I thought they did, and so to learn how all things had a beginning. And for that purpose, I have often taken up a book and have talked to it, and then put my ears to it when alone, in hopes it would answer me. And I have been very much concerned when I found it remain silent. So in this example, the talking book talks to others, right? Does not talk to Equiano.
It's an untalking book.
It is an untalking book.
And just to put this in perspective, so these were slaves who had come from an oral tradition in Africa. And I can just imagine that when they were then in slavery, they would see their masters reading from a book, often the Bible, reading and then talking. And it must have seemed like the book itself was talking.
Was speaking to them, yeah. And that is often how it is described. Over time, the idea of this book as a mystical object, as a fetish, as an object of power changed as these enslaved Africans who had been transformed into commodities realized that there was power in that book, and in perhaps desiring to master the book, to get the book to talk to them was in fact then a goal. And that is very tied into the early beginning of the literary tradition with regards to slave narratives wanting to tell their own stories. So it's got an interesting tension there.
Well, this is such a complicated history here, such a fascinating history, because on the one hand, you're talking about the empowerment that comes with literacy, with learning to read and write. And so that it's not just sort of, the slave master is reading this book, and it's as if the book itself is taught. I mean, I can take on that tradition. I can make the book talk in a way. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, it's you're also talking about this literary tradition that's going up against the oral tradition in some way. It's almost as if you're losing something as you become literate.
Right. And as we move through the 19th century, you have slaves beginning to write their own stories, and and often using in their subtitles or part of their titles, written by himself or written by herself. And many of them position those moments when they learn to read, many of them begin to equate that with freedom or with the steps towards freedom. Frederick Douglass famously does that when he talks about how reading certain documents enabled him to understand himself as a thinking person, and then began to actually make him uneasy about his situation, right? So he really connects this idea of enlightenment to literacy. But then others begin to question that, thinking, well, people knew they weren't free before they knew how to read, right?
Right.
When reading doesn't necessarily make you aware of that. And that's where within this literature, you begin to see these tensions between the oral tradition and the value of that versus a written tradition that's associated with power and in some cases oppressive power, right? If we think about the way that the Bible, certainly it was a magic book that slaves wanted to gain mastery of, but it was also a book that people interpreted in ways that helped to oppress the population as well.
Well, of course, the Bible has this fascinating history. Speaking of double-voiced or double-edged, I mean, the Bible was used by slave owners to justify slavery. I mean, there are passages in the Bible that justify, but there are other passages that justify liberation, freedom, the story of Exodus. And so, you know, you can interpret the Bible in these two different ways. I mean, specifically regarding the whole issue of slavery.
Right. And I think that issue of interpretation was why enslaved Africans strove to gain literacy, right? So they could read it for themselves, interpret it for themselves, and then begin to use those arguments, those moral arguments, in the service of abolition. And that probably, in terms of mastery of a text, was one of the most significant turns, right, into, or at least in the early stages when writing was really fused with political activism.
Right. So what happens to this tradition of the talking book as we move ahead in history into the late 19th, 20th century? I mean, does that tradition of the talking book still survive?
Well, I think it does in the sense that the tension or that combination between wanting to preserve oral histories within literary ones, you do see it especially in the historic fiction of the late 20th century and early 21st century. Writers like Toni Morrison, who write historical novels about slavery, you see the books appear in those texts. And the books are not always, print isn't always favorable.
What would be an example of that in, say, a Toni Morrison novel?
Well, she writes about the book a lot. And I think probably, I want to say, her best example of thinking about this idea of the talking book is probably the book Jazz. But I feel like in Beloved, you have Setha realizing or beginning to understand partly the way in which she's been dehumanized, because she sees the school teacher, who's her master, writing about her in this book, right? She doesn't know what he's writing, but she knows that there's something pernicious about it. So in that case, the book has power, but it has the kind of power that she actually has to counter with her own oral narrative. So throughout Beloved, Setha is always telling her story, right, in different ways, even though she very often wants to repress the story. And one of the most powerful moments in Beloved, without totally spoiling it for those who haven't read it at this point, is when the figure of Beloved, who may or may not be the ghost of Setha's murdered daughter, is exorcised by 30 singing women. And the way it's described is they utter the sound that broke the back of words. And it's this beautiful moment, but it's interesting to think of that notion of needing to break the back of words, right, to counter something that is written with the power, the collective oral power of these women or the community coming together.
Do you think there still is this tension between the oral tradition and the written word today, especially within African-American circles?
I think that you see it now probably most prominently, and I wouldn't necessarily call it a division, but with the popularity of spoken word poetry that is primarily performed. Now, poetry has always had that performative aspect, especially African-American poetry. There's always been this attentiveness to the line, to rhythm, to timing. So in many ways, these traditions are really fused. But there are authors who really feel strongly that the poem has to also work on the page. And so they are very much connected to the book in that way, that they see themselves as poets who write poetry that's meant to be written and that has to look a very particular way. It's structured in a certain form. It might function as an oral text as well, but the primary importance is how it looks and how it reads on the page, whereas there are also spoken word artists that really don't see the page as their medium, right? They're freed up to present their work in different forms, almost as dramatic monologues. They are very much tied to stand-up. They're tied to the tradition of hip-hop and toast-telling, right, which very much goes back to this idea of exchanging lies, as Zora Neale Hurston would have called them. So I think that tension is still present there, but I do feel like there is something freeing, perhaps, in getting off or getting away from the book in that way. And I do feel like digital media, in allowing us to begin to both hear and see words moving in really innovative ways, is an interesting connection, I think, between the two, right? Mm. So that the page is now the screen, and the way in which lines don't stay in one place anymore, and you can both hear them and see them at the same time. So that might be a unique way of how these oral and written traditions are still continuing to fuse together.
Shireen Sherrard Johnson on The Talking Book in African American Literature. She's a professor of English at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Steve Paulson spoke with her.